like you're going to be a guy who works at a pawn shop, and that's it. And we're going to make a movie. And I'm like, how long is this going to take? She says 2 weeks. I'm like, really? All right, then. All right, I'll do it.
Today on The Frame Weekend, how Marc Maron and filmmaker Lynn Shelton threw together an improvised movie in a matter of days. Later, for a movie about toxic masculinity in a karate studio, stunt coordinator Mindy Kelly choreographed some very brutal fight scenes.
We watch so many superhero movies where hundreds of people are getting killed and no one feels anything. So having the one arm break and someone feel something, that's what I wanted to do with action and action design, is that, like, we are humans. We do hurt. We feel everything.
And we visit with Linda Ronstadt as she celebrates her 73rd birthday. It's The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. Stick with us. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. Later on the show, we meet a singer-songwriter who is so inspired by Bob Dylan that he moved to Dylan's birthplace in Minnesota from his home in Kenya. But we'll start with a new movie from director Lynn Shelton. It's called Sword of Trust, and it deals with addiction, racism, American history, conspiracy theories, and it's a comedy set in a pawn shop. The movie stars Marc Maron, and he plays the owner of that pawn shop. It's in Birmingham, Alabama, and he has come into possession of an antique sword. And there's some shady characters who think the sword can somehow help prove that the South actually won the Civil War. Like a lot of Shelton's movies, Sword of Trust is largely improvised. And Shelton and Maron know how to work with each other. She directed him in the Netflix series Glow and also in his own TV show called Maron.
The thing was, Lynn and I had been writing a script for almost 3 years, and we're still writing it. And we just kept chipping away at this, and she was getting anxious. She wanted to make a movie. And then one day she just said, all right, so, you know, I have an idea. I have a script. I had you in mind. This is your character. She wanted to work with me in a movie, and I was just sort of like procrastinating. We weren't finishing the script, and I didn't think it would ever happen. And then all of a sudden she's like, you're gonna be a guy who works at a pawn shop, and that's it. And we're going to make a movie. And I'm like, how long is this going to take? Then my manager would call me and be like, I think this Lynn Shelton movie is going to happen. And I'm like, really? And he's like, yeah, they're going to shoot in Alabama. And I'm like, how long is it going to take? And he goes, she says 2 weeks. I'm like, really? All right, then. All right, I'll do it. And then the conversations I was having with Lynn were like, oh, that sounds great, Lynn. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, that sounds good. And we'll knock it out. It's going to be great.
I want to play a scene that, Mark, is your character, Mel, trying to authenticate the sword at the center of the story.
This was given to my great-great-great-great-grandpappy, mm-hmm. who was a field marshal mm-hmm. in the Confederate Army.
Yeah.
And this was surrendered to him by General Sherman.
Sheridan.
It was surrendered to him by a Union general.
Mm-hmm. What
battle are we talking about here?
This battle? Oh. It's Chickabauga.
Chickabauga?
Chickabauga.
I don't think that battle.
Not familiar with it?
I don't think it happened.
Well, it happened.
Okay.
I assure you, 30,000 men lost their lives that day.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
You probably haven't heard of it because it's buried.
What do you mean buried?
It is buried from the history books.
Yeah.
By Deep State.
That's also Jillian Bell and Michaela Watkins in the scene. Lynn, what kind of framework do you give for your actors in a scene like that? How much is scripted? How much of it is we have to get from point A to point B?
What I gave them was a 50-page, what I call a scriptment. It's sort of half script, half treatment. So the plot is really tightly structured, and we know what has to unfold. But for the most part, they're finding their way through the beats of the scene. They're coming up with it all on their own. And then in the edit room is my editor, Tyler Cook, and I are really the ones, you know, who are writing the final draft. So, yeah, it's quite a, it's a terrifying process because you don't know if you're going to get all the ingredients or all the right ingredients to make a really good dinner when you're in the edit room. But it's also a really exciting and dynamic and yeah, just exhilarating way to work, because if you've got the correct cast, and that is absolutely essential for a movie like this, it's just amazing what they'll come up with. And then I just have to make sure not to laugh too hard and ruin every take.
Mark, what is it like as an actor? Some actors find that liberating, some find it terrifying, some find it both at the same time.
I loved it. I thought it was exciting. It was a little intimidating at first because the other actors were, you know, they're real beasts when it comes to improvising, and I was a little intimidated. But, you know, once I realized what my emotional foundation was in the movie and my character and how that guy would interact, it's very comfortable for me. I certainly wasn't scared of it, and it's very exciting to be that present in something. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why I got into stand-up originally was that, you know, when I'm on a stand-up stage and I'm doing it, you know, I'm really in it, and I'm in life, and I'm in the present. I don't know what's going to happen or what my relationship with the audience is going to evolve into in any given performance. And so I got that, you know, on set with this group of actors. You know, there are takes where, you know, there's like whatever's on the cutting room floor of this movie is bona fide hysterical stuff. And also there are, you know, very touching moments that they just happen out of nowhere. And I think you can feel that when you watch the movie. When I watched it, you don't know where the story's going to go. And all the jokes sort of happen organically. And, you know, it's getting big laughs. I can't remember the last time I was in a movie where, you know, it was getting genuine laughter.
We're talking with Lynn Shelton and Mark Maron about the movie Sword of Trust. Part of the idea of the story is whether or not this sword is authentic. But there's a bigger idea about the characters' lives. And I want to play a clip from later in the film, Mark, where your character Mel has been asked a question by Cynthia, who's played by Jillian Bell.
What about the girl?
I guess we missed each other and, you know, she said she was going to clean up. She said she was clean. She'd come down here and stay clean, and we can do the music down here. And so she comes down here, and it's okay for a little while. But then she figures out a way to find the people that get f***ed up, and she got f***ed up, and I didn't get f***ed up. I just watch her go in and out.
It's a scene where you learn the backstory of the main character, but it doesn't feel really scripted, doesn't feel expositional. And it's really serious. So, Lynn and Mark, I want to ask you about that scene and how it came together and what you gave Mark, and Mark, what you gave Lynn.
Go ahead, Lynn.
You know, there's some scenes that were sort of written out and there was dialogue to, you know, you could take it or leave it or whatever. But this scene read, they get to know each other in the back of the van.
Wow.
And it became the heart of the whole movie.
Definitely.
But that being said, going into a movie like this, there's a lot of work put in beforehand on backstory. So it wasn't that, like, Mark opened his mouth and I had no idea what it was going to come out. Like, we had discussed beforehand what that might look like. The specificity, though, of how that story unfolds, how the other characters draw it out of him, like, all of that we figured out on the day. They figured out, you know, really, with a little bit of steering here and there from me. But it was really, all the heavy lifting was the actors. And it was, I believe we had something like 9 hours of footage just from that one day.
Somehow or another, you know, in terms of my own experience with, you know, being sober and also my own experience with addiction, it's weird that what's happening for me when I do these roles is that I am able to kind of plant memories into my head that aren't specifically mine, but I can make them mine. And a lot of the story that I manufactured for that monologue comes out of my time that I spent on the Lower East Side of New York in the late 80s, living in a neighborhood that was, you know, primarily a heroin open air market, and, you know, seeing the people that would sort of come down the street every day to buy dope and to sort of be living in that world and getting to know, if only by, you know, just familiarity of seeing them over and over again in the neighborhood, and making assumptions about what their lives must be like. Like, there are these bits and pieces of my past that sort of became my life for the character.
Lynn Shelton is the director, co-writer, and a featured actor in Sword of Trust. Mark Maron stars in the film as Mel. Lynn and Mark, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, John.
Sword of Trust is in select theaters now, and the music you're hearing was composed and performed for the film by Mark Maron. It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn, and this weekend, a whole lot of people working in TV are celebrating because they have Emmy nominations. Those were announced earlier this week. But before we get to the nominees, we put together a little something for all those sad souls on the snub list.
Hey, can you believe Julia Roberts did not receive a nod? Can you believe they overlooked Richard Madden in The Bodyguard? No, I cannot believe Big Bang Theory reconsider it. I wish they would. Can you believe there was no nomination from the guy from Deadwood? I'm talking snub list, snub list, snub list, snub list. And old George Clooney was a shoo-in for Catch-22. Emma Stone and Sarah Paulson and even Jim Carrey too. Woke up in the morning with some tender hope in their hearts. But now they're on the snub list, baby, no recognition for their art. I'm talking snub list, snub list, snub list, snub list.
That song was composed, produced, arranged, and performed by The Frame's own Paul Ratliff. Now, what about those people who weren't in Paul's song, the nominees? Yes, Game of Thrones set a record with 32 nominations, and its cable channel, HBO, collected the most total nominations. But there's a lot more to the Emmys than pay cable and Swords and Dragons. Lorraine Olley is the TV critic for the LA Times.
And the limited series category this year has got some of the strongest contenders of any category, and which is unusual because you have like When They See Us, Chernobyl, Escape from Dannemora. All of these are in that category, and for it to be so strong, but Chernobyl particularly came in something like fourth in the number of nominations. For a limited series, that's kind of astounding. And if you're not familiar with it, it is the story of Chernobyl, the meltdown, Soviet-era Russia.
Third. It was third. Game of Thrones was most. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel was second. Chernobyl was third with 19 nominations, more than Saturday Night Live with 18, and Barry and Fosse Verdon was 17. So,
see, you know, everybody loves a nuclear meltdown, really.
Who doesn't?
I mean, what says entertainment more than that, really?
Obviously, there's some big shows like Veep and Game of Thrones that are going away, do you start to see some shows that are really starting to rise up as other shows that have been around for a while and been very critically acclaimed and won a lot of trophies start to go away?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing in what's ahead or what's rising up now is a darker sort of comedy, some comedies or dramas underpinned by a lot more realism. When They See Us, about the Central Park Five, also came in very high, a limited
16,
series.
16
right.
Nominations.
Heavy-duty material. I mean, heavy-duty subject matter, you know, about these five young men who were wrongly convicted and spent decades in jail for that assault and rape in Central Park in 1989. That being in the top tier was something as whimsical as The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and as Game of Thrones. That kind of tells you something. That's the newcomer, right? That's a newcomer. Chernobyl's a newcomer. Russian Doll. Even Barry, I would argue, is kind of a newcomer compared to those shows. And it's much darker. And it does kind of...
It's about a hitman. Of course. It's very dark.
But it's so funny.
It is very funny.
It's funny murder, John. It's
about
funny.
A hitman who wants to become an actor. Why? What is wrong with that concept? So does that mean that... The Television Academy is embracing darker material. The best shows tend to be dark, or what else?
I think it's kind of reflecting what we need to see, what we need to laugh at. And things are kind of dark right now. So, and I would even argue that The Good Place, which isn't particularly a dark show, it deals with like death, essentially, what happens after you die.
Why are these awards important, or the nominations? Because a ton of money was spent on promotions. There are all these four-year consideration events. It has become its own nuclear meltdown in terms of spending. And for Netflix, it obviously means something in terms of attracting talent. HBO, it drives subscriptions. If you look really closely, HBO had almost as many nominations as all of the broadcast networks combined. If you look at ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox, they had 145 total. HBO had 137, eight fewer than all of the four networks combined. So what does that tell us about shifting strategies and why the better shows, are they just the better shows, or are they spending more promoting them?
See, I don't think we're in the nuclear meltdown phase. I think we're in the arms race right now.
Good.
Okay, we're headed up that way, right? And, you know, the shifting of the broadcast network shows not having the sort of gravitas that they used to, obviously that's been tipping for a while. But I think television is arguably turning out more experimental, daring, and better stuff than film is right now.
No argument. No argument at all. Film is all superheroes all the time.
Okay, see, and there
totally
you go.
Agree. I think we can agree that a lot of edgier, darker material was recognized in the Emmy nominations. But what does it tell us about where TV can go and get better in terms of inclusion, in terms of experimentation? Look at some categories. Not a lot of Latino actors represented in any categories. Where do you see potential progress?
I see progress in what we're looking at in terms of women. A lot of the programming here is either female-centric in terms of the story, the cast, the showrunners. I think this list has probably got the most representation of that I've seen. It makes me feel like I wonder if the Emmy voters are like, okay, we got that one. We got the women. So like, okay, we can drop this other diversity thing and just move forward with, you know, whatever it is that we need to do. Game of Thrones, we love you. You know, I don't know. And we got Pose in there, so we're good. I don't know. I mean, this stuff takes a long time, and changing that stuff from the inside takes a long time. And I would say the push to have more women behind the camera has probably been more successful in television than in terms of getting more people of color. And I think it's just going to take a long time, because some of the stuff we see bubbling up, Rami, One Day at a Time's coming back, all of those things have potential moving forward.
Lorraine Ollie is the TV critic for the LA Times. Lorraine, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Coming up, David Crosby is the subject of a mea culpa documentary, and Linda Ronstadt celebrates a birthday and gets some love for her lifetime in music. That's all next on The Frame Weekend. David Crosby is best known for making music with Stephen Stills, Graham Nash, and Neil Young, but he's also known for having pretty much ruined his relationships with all of those guys and many, many others.
One morning, I woke up.
He comes clean about that and his ups and downs, including a stint in prison, in the new documentary, David Crosby, Remember My Name. The film is produced by Almost Famous director Cameron Crowe, who was once a young rock journalist. The documentary's director is A.J. Eaton. I sat down with Eaton, Crowe, and David Crosby after the movie premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in January. It was a little bit like a therapy session in the Frame condo.
They really did not give me any place to hide at all. They weren't merciless, but they were determined, because he's known me since he was 17. He knows everything that's happened. We've talked a lot. He's my friend.
Cameron, I want to ask you about your journalistic relationship with David. There's a point in the film where you pull out a tape that you have saved for many years. I think it's one of the first interviews that you did with David. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with David and why you had some questions that you still had left to ask?
Well, John, I ran into them, AJ and David, as they were just starting to talk to people about doing a documentary. And my feeling was, just looking at David, he's ready to talk. He's ready to go there. So I said to these guys, I'm doing other stuff, but just let me interview him, because I saw that look in his eyes. And that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to like give AJ interviews for his documentary. And I knew David from when I was 17, he was one of the first interviews I ever did. I was so grateful that he made the time to do it because he didn't do interviews in the day. He kind of, you know, shined a little grace upon a kid journalist, right? So I had like so many questions for him. And I got through every one of them. He spent hours with me. I was 17. And these were the greatest answers ever. So I thought, you know, I'll come in, I'll do some interviews with these guys. And then the waters got so deep and the feelings got so rich, I became more and more involved with Glee.
But to make the film as honest as you want to make it, even if you're friends and even if you have great respect for David, it means you have to go to some places that are going to be uncomfortable. And it could be about busted relationships. It could be about something as painful to watch, and I think you'll agree, as you and Stephen and Graham singing Silent Night on some TV thing.
Holy night, Son of God.
Yeah, it's all painful. Point was, are we going to duck that stuff and just put a ribbon on it and say, gee, David Crosby was so peachy keen? No. There's a story to be told, and we're not in it to put fluff out there. We did talk about some painful stuff, and yeah, that was a painful moment. They had our monitor mixes switched. Stills was hearing my monitor, and I was hearing his, so he couldn't get any pitch at all. So he was like, wildly out of tune. Wasn't really his fault. It was a screw up by the monitor mixer there. But it sounded like we felt.
It's a vivid moment in the film. I don't think David was sure we were going to use it or not.
I told him not to. They totally ignored me on everything like that. There's several places I said, do not do that.
I never heard that. So I was just so happy to have that in the film because it's so freaking real.
AJ and Cameron, there are certain people who are central to the story, Joni Mitchell, Graham Nash. Did you try to talk to them? Did they not want to talk? How did you go about that?
We just made a conscientious decision that we wanted Crosby to be the sole narrator of his story. And so when we first put the first assembly together, we realized that those people and the portrait that Crosby paints with them in the movie, I didn't need that.
A lot of the people that he's worked with and his collaborators are still in our kind of circle of people that we know and work with. And many of them have reached out to us throughout and just said, just be honest. Say hi to David. Good luck.
We're talking with David Crosby, director A.J. Eaton, and producer Cameron Crowe about the documentary David Crosby, Remember My Name. David, I'm going to ask you this last question. People who know you, know your music, maybe know something about your life. If they go into this movie and are changed by seeing it and how they see you and how they understand you, how do you hope people might be changed and their understanding of you might be changed?
I would hope that they would think that I wasn't just a rambunctious a-hole. You know, I would hope that they could see that there was a thought process behind most of what I did. Not all, but most. And I think that I'm a good lesson in the sense that I'm a very imperfect being. It's blatantly obvious. I'm also trying pretty hard to be a decent guy. And I think if people, you know, look at the guy that they're looking at in the movie, they're going to say, you know, this is a mixed bag. And I shouldn't judge people on one color. You know, people are not a single entity uniformly. They have all kinds of stuff in them. And it's not one picture. It's not one uniform person. And none of us are. You aren't. She isn't. He isn't. And that's a good lesson to learn.
That was David Crosby with filmmakers Cameron Crowe and A.J. Eaton. The documentary David Crosby, Remember My Name, is in select theaters now. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Another singer-songwriter who will be the subject of an upcoming documentary is Linda Ronstadt. This week, the singer turns 73, but the celebration actually started a couple of weeks ago when she was honored by a cultural center here in L.A.
The Frame contributor Beto Arcos was there, and he later spoke with Ronstadt about her influences and the album Live in Hollywood. It's a concert recording of hers from the early 80s.
I sat down with Linda Ronstadt at her hotel room the day after she was honored at La Plaza de Cultura y Artes, an art center in downtown L.A. Throughout her career, Ronstadt has received all kinds of major awards and recognition. But she says the celebration that took place at La Plaza was special.
I don't usually like things like that, but with Mexicans, it's fun. It's a different feeling. I feel like I'm at home.
Ronstadt's celebration was indeed close to home. Her uncle, José Ronstadt, shared a family story from the stage. In the late 1990s, in the middle of a concert in Tucson, the great Mexican ranchera singer Lola Beltrán stopped the show and asked a question.
Is Mr. Ronstadt here? Gilbert Ronstadt, Linda's dad. She asked Gilbert to come up to the front of the stage. She had beautiful sarapin reboso blanco de seda. She took it away and she says, Mr. Ronstadt, on behalf of every Mexicano, I want you to give this to your daughter Linda. It's because of Linda that the music of mariachi will never die.
Mexican music and culture have been a part of Ronstadt since she can remember. She was 8 years old when she first heard Beltrán, who made a strong impression on her.
My dad would make a business trip to Mexico every year, and he'd always come back with a bunch of records. He'd bring back Trio Los Panchos, Los Calaveras, Pedro Tariacuri, Amalia Mendoza, Miguel Aceves Mejia, and Lola Beltrán primarily. I just fell in love with her music.
In 1987 and again in 1991, Ronstadt released albums that paid homage to that music.
Mariquita se llamaba la que vive junto al río. Tápame con tu rebozo que ya me muero de frío.
When I wanted to become a professional singer, I wanted to learn those songs. And in those days, you couldn't look up on the internet, you know, and find it. I'd have a scratchy record for my dad, and I couldn't find the lyrics. And I don't speak Spanish, so I didn't know how to have a way to write them down and learn them from the record, so I just learned the melodies.
I'm going back someday, come what may, to Dubai.
The influence of Mexican music in her pop songs first appear in Roy Orbison's Blue Bayou, a song she recorded in 1977. Ronstadt says she was trying to channel the deep emotion of the Mexican singer she adored.
It just made me think of a Mexican song, especially that big chorus. And I had a hard time finding a resonance in American pop music because the rhythm culture is really black church at the time that we were doing it, you know, the late 60s and the early 70s.
Blue Bayou and 11 other songs are part of the album Live in Hollywood, recorded before a small audience in 1980. Ronstadt remembers vividly the night of the fabled concert.
I was in a television studio and it was a small audience and it was hotter than hell. It was just too hot to work. That's all I remember, just for sweating and trying to sing.
Ronstadt reminisced about the exciting time when she arrived in Los Angeles from Tucson. The Troubadour Club was at the heart of the music scene in the mid-1960s. She says anybody who played well hung out at the club, and it became like a big, close-knit family.
And Joni Mitchell and Carole King and Elton John and James Taylor, everybody, Neil Young, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, they all played the Troubadour. And so you got to hear him going. You got to hear him over several nights.
I read that recently in an article that you were there when Elton John made his debut at the Troubadour.
I was. He came in and sat in and did a guest set. It was crowded that night, so we were all standing up in the balcony. And I remember he came on stage and it was just like an explosion. But I saw Joni Mitchell there for 2 weeks. She played 2 weeks. I went and saw every single show, 2 shows a night, 3 shows on weekends. I went and saw every show she did. It was amazing.
Raindrops fall.
These days, Ronstadt rarely goes out to concerts. She retired in 2011 and was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2012.
But going into a big place is physically impossible for me. I go to the opera when I can get a chance, the opera and the ballet.
I asked Ronstadt if she's seen any young singers recently. When I mentioned La Marisol, lead vocalist of La Santa Cecilia, who performed at La Plaza, Ronstadt was excited to talk about her.
I love her. I've been stalking her on YouTube, and she's so honest. She's got a great voice, and she's dead serious about the music, and it just shows.
There's an upcoming documentary about Ronstadt's career. When I asked her about it, at first she appeared reluctant to comment.
I saw a rough cut. I didn't have anything to do with it. It's a weird feeling being examined that closely, you know. It was weird to watch it. It's like watching your whole life flash before your eyes. I've been walked by the rain, driven by the snow, I'm drunk and dirty. Don't you know that I'm still willing.
The documentary, titled The Sound of My Voice, is due out in September. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. This week marks the historic 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. I was camping with my family and listened to it on the car radio. Not quite as good as watching on TV, but at least I was outside and I could see the moon. To mark the occasion, a truly remarkable documentary is getting re-released in some theaters. Apollo 11 is largely assembled from previously unseen footage and unheard audio, culled from thousands of hours of film reels and sound recordings. When the film came out in March, I spoke with its director, Todd Douglas Miller, and he talked about how he and his team worked with NASA and the National Archives, which led them to a big discovery.
Some of the research team at National Archives had come across in May of 2017 some reels. And, you know, they didn't say exactly what was on them. They were labeled Apollo 11. Some had the dates of the launch, which was July 16th, 1969 on them. We put them on the scanner, and needless to say, our jaws were just absolutely on the floor.
This is the 65-millimeter footage, right? It's almost as big as an IMAX frame now.
That's correct. So suffice it to say, that was one part of it.
Yeah, you're just talking about the visuals. There's also 11,000 hours of audio recordings. Is that right?
It was actually 18,000 hours of Apollo Air mission control audio. 11,000 hours, as you said, were directly related to Apollo 11.
Now 5 minutes, 52 seconds, and counting.
Booster flight.
CPSS, verify go for launch.
CPSS, verify go for launch.
CTSC, verify go for launch.
Booster flight.
Verify go for launch. SRO, verify go for launch.
As I've told people before, who have asked about how do you start editing? There is a 9-day version of the film that exists.
A little longer than most films.
Yeah, just a little bit longer, but we tried to get every available piece, every single frame, every single audio clip that we could, and lay it out in a timeline so we could see what we got.
You made a decision very early on about the nature of the story, and that was going to be there wasn't going to be talking heads. There weren't going to be people explaining what was happening at any given moment. The footage and the audio would more or less speak for itself. Why was that decision important, and how did it dictate what you were and were not going to use?
Yeah, it was always the plan from the start, even before the large format came out. If you were around during the missions, you listened to them, they had a wonderful quote-unquote narrator in the public affairs officer. There was anywhere from 4 to 5 in each mission. He sat in mission control right next to all the other flight controllers back behind the flight director and basically distilled down all the technical jargon that was being said on the air-to-ground transmissions between the astronauts and mission control.
We have some 7.6 million pounds of thrust pushing the vehicle upward. A vehicle that weighs close to 6.5 million pounds.
You also make a thematic choice to talk about process and not about heroes. And that is about the people who are behind the scenes. There's a sequence toward the end of the film where one of the astronauts is thanking the people who actually built the spacecraft. Why was that important?
Well, I think you can't tell the story of Apollo 11 or any of the other Apollo missions and the overall program without doing the research of who these people were. And the minute you ask that question, you're immediately exposed to numbers. Hundreds of thousands of people spread across tens of thousands of companies. And it always just struck me. And then to see footage of the workers, footage of not only mission control in the firing room, people that built the spacecraft, people that built the machinery to transport the spacecraft. One thing that was never lost on me in any of the footage was how young the mission controllers were, how young all the people were. I think there's a misunderstood theme with that era. Just because it was 50 years old, it was these, you know, older people that were working on it. Not so. Most of those flight controllers were in their 20s. The astronauts themselves were in their late 30s. They were the veterans. People looked up to them.
I'm going to play a piece of music. It's a song by John Stewart called Mother Country.
Oh, Mother Country, I do love you.
It's probably not a song that a lot of people know about, but it plays a central role in the astronauts' return to Earth. How does it figure into the story, and how did you hear about it?
Well, when we first got the audio, not only this 11,000 hours, but we also had the onboard, the air-to-ground, and on one of the onboard tracks, my producing partner, Tom Peterson, actually found this. We kind of had a divide and conquer approach. We had so much audio. We were enlisting everyone to listen to, hours and hours of footage. And Tom was just walking to work one day, listening to, the onboard audio. Shortly before the guys went to bed, Buzz, just like in the movie, says, "Hey, you guys want to play some music?" And about three or four songs in was this amazing track by this folk artist, John Stewart. He has since passed away, but his wife, Buffy Ford Stewart, we tracked her down. They never had heard this. John didn't know about it. They were friends of all these astronauts. So it was a real honor to present his music for the first time in the film.
The feature-length documentary Apollo 11 can be seen in select theaters. A shorter version of the film is on the IMAX screen at the California Science Center. Coming up, J.S. Ondara wanted to follow in the footsteps of American folk legend Bob Dylan. He had one minor geographical problem. That's next on The Frame Weekend. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. There's a new martial arts film that is kicking its way into theaters this weekend, and this one might leave you with some deeper thoughts than, say, Wax On, Wax Off from The Karate Kid. The Art of Self-Defense stars Jesse Eisenberg. He plays a timid man who decides to join a dojo after being brutally beaten.
You came to the right place. You're learning karate. You're a blade, and I'm sharpening you. There's a mental component as well.
You mean like believing in myself?
Yeah, that won't hurt. I'm talking about something a little different. What's your favorite style of music?
Adult contemporary?
No, should be metal. You ever listen to metal?
You mean like hard rock?
Metal is much more aggressive than hard rock. From now on, you'll listen to metal.
Yeah.
It's the toughest music there is.
The Karate Studio is run by a terrifying sensei who believes that real men only listen to heavy metal music and that women will never be as good as men. On the set, the film's writer-director, Riley Stearns, took a decidedly opposite view than that fictional sensei, mostly hiring women to head up his departments. And that includes the film's stunt coordinator and fight choreographer, Mindy Kelly. The two of them recently came to the Frame Studios to talk about their collaboration on the art of self-defense.
I made the decision a long time ago that I wanted to stunt coordinate and not just be a performer. And that's why I built my name up from music videos. And from that, by word of mouth, I don't have an agent or manager. I've just, by word of mouth, booked and had a career.
It's all been relationships. Like everyone who's brought her name up has worked with her. So it was personal experiences that kind of brought us together. Yeah.
And what were the origins of the story? Where did it start to coalesce?
Once I kind of figured out the setting, it really was a matter of just saying, what's interesting to me? What have I been thinking about? And I really started kind of being honest with myself that I didn't know who I was as a man, didn't kind of understand society's expectations of me as a man. And those thoughts and fears really just started seeping their way into this script. So yeah, trying to pitch my agent's manager, like I'm doing this like dark comedy set in the world of karate, but it's about masculinity and how dumb men can be sometimes. They definitely didn't understand it at first, but they told me to just run with it and see where it was going to take me. And it's crazy how much it made sense to me, even though it's such a weird kind of amalgamation of all these different thoughts and ideas.
We're talking with Riley Stearns, the writer-director of The Art of Self-Defense, and Mindy Kelly, who is the film's stunt coordinator and fight choreographer. And while it's a black comedy, Mindy, the violence in it is very real. So when you are thinking about the stunts and how you're going to depict violence, what were the conversations you had with Riley? How did you work to make sure that it looked like people were really getting hurt badly?
First of all, that means I did my job.
Yeah.
And I did it well to get a response. But that's how you create change, is by making people feel uncomfortable. Like, we watch so many superhero movies where hundreds of people are getting killed and no one feels anything.
Yeah.
So having the one arm break and someone feel something, like, that's what I wanted to do with action and action design, is that we feel like we are humans. We do hurt. We feel everything. And so Riley, like, he wanted it to be shot in a way where there's like no camera speed ramping or anything that did feel gritty, grounded, and real. And
speed ramping would be a device to make it look like
It's just camera tricks.
Yeah, kind of matrixy.
Yeah.
We didn't want any of that. And we wanted the first part of the movie to feel more formalistic and like show karate in the way that you've seen it done on film before. And then as the film progresses, there's a grittiness to it. And like Mindy definitely had like scenes where she could go more movie foo, which is like a version of karate or kung fu where it works on screen in a different way. And then we wanted a part of the film where it turned more brutal and animalistic. And Mindy was able to kind of like give me exactly what I needed depending on the scene.
What is this idea of movie foo as opposed to kung fu? What does it entail? How much of that did you try to incorporate in the film? And what were your marching orders from Riley?
Well, movie foo is something that I've actually been studying for over a decade now, because when I moved to Hollywood, I realized that everything that I knew about martial arts or films, you had to completely throw out the window. Because like MMA fighters or anything like that, that doesn't sell on camera.
In terms of like grappling, in terms of like strikes?
You don't want to hurt somebody.
Okay.
So you have to sell something without actually making contact and knowing your distance, knowing your own. Like, you have to be able to know that you're doing a back spinning hook kick. When you turn around, the actor didn't duck. So you have to be able to stop yourself so you don't kick him in the face. You can only do so many punches, right, in a fight scene, but it's how you play that punch. It's the emotional intention behind that, and that's what brings it to life.
And it's as real as it can be without people having broken noses.
Exactly.
And even too, it's funny that like sometimes you'll see actors want to actually hurt each other. Like if you're slapping somebody in the scene, you really do it. Sometimes real is not what you're after. Sometimes you do need the movie version of something and it sells it more, which is always a learning experience for me. But Mindy's great at knowing what you need to do to actually sell it on camera.
Riley Stearns is the writer and director of The Art of Self-Defense. Mindy Kelly is the film's stunt coordinator and fight choreographer. Riley and Mindy, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
The Art of Self-Defense is in theaters now. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Our final story today is about a man who came to the United States to pursue a dream of becoming an American folk musician. The story comes to us from The Current. That's an all-music public radio station in St. Paul, Minnesota, and it's part of American Public Media, which also operates KPCC. The Current hosts in-studio interviews and performances with up-and-coming musicians, and our colleagues are sharing some of those sessions with us. We launch our collaboration with J.S. Ondara. He's a singer-songwriter from Kenya, and he became so taken with the music of Bob Dylan that he packed up and moved from Africa to his hero's home state of Minnesota.
There was no way I was going to be able to do what I'm doing now, to become a folk singer around there with the people that were around me for starters, because, you know, they wouldn't let me. The culture there does not really put enough precedence on arts, and that sort of mentality spills over into family structures and all that. So, you know, I had a lot of pressure just not to pursue music. And I sort of felt like I needed to be somewhere different where I could find ears for what I was trying to do. I think because of the sort of lack of emphasis on the arts, that ends up becoming a problem in the society in such a way that it doesn't provide an infrastructure for careers in arts to excel. So there's a lot of layers of reasons, but, you know, I think I had it set in my head that I had to leave. I just had to go. I love my home, but I had to leave so I could, you know, to this. I'm just getting good at saying goodbye. Getting good at saying goodbye. Getting good. You know, as a boy, you dream about things. You know, it's what you do. You dream about flying spaceships. You dream about going on a date to the moon, or, you know, flying to an alternate universe. It's just what you do as a boy. So I dreamt about all that, and then I also dreamt about moving to America and making a record called Tales of America, just as a foolish dream as a boy. He was just an American dream. He was just an American dream. Somehow, you know, through just a series of strange events, one thing leading to the next, that part of my foolish dreaming has come to fruition in some bizarre way. He was just an American dream. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, my mom would give me money to go to school, and I, you know, like a bus fare, and instead of going to school, I'd just go to the internet cafe and just consume music. Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? Growing up listening to all this Bob Dylan, it felt like I was in a spaceship and I was traveling to a completely different universe where everyone spoke a different language, everyone, you know, looked different, they sounded different, they did different things. It was a spaceship. That's what music was for me as a child, and it transported me to somewhere. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. As the internet became a thing and I started spending all my days on the internet instead of going to school, sorry, Mom, the idea of what a success in music could be was forming at that point, when I could see performances of, you know, people performing online and thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe I could do that, maybe, who knows, maybe. When you're in different places outside of America and you're thinking about America, you don't necessarily think of New York or LA, you just think of America because it's this huge place that you see on TV. And since I was in high school and I was discovering Dylan, and I was like, okay, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to move to Minnesota, and I think I'm going to try to start a career in music. And so the first thing I did was apply to the University of Minnesota, tried applying to, you know, jobs and everything, tried everything really. Nothing really ever worked until it did, just by pure chance at some point, like when I'm about to give up. The whole journey to come into America, it was just impossible. Will you let me in? It ended up being just a thing of putting one foot in front of the next, you know, learning the guitar, started putting all these poems and stories I was writing into melodies, and you know, got out there, started playing these songs as soon as I could. I figured out a few chords, and this is it. This is what I came here to do. It's precisely this, is to tell stories and to travel around the world telling them. So it's just moving on. It's just another record, another batch of stories. And, you know, hopefully by telling stories and, you know, sort of communing with people through that in live shows, hopefully make some kind of, you know, positive influence on people's lives, or, you know, just the general society and civilization.
Oh, God bless America, the heartache of mine.
J.S. Ondara's debut album, Tales of America, is available on streaming services, and you can hear more of that session at thecurrent.org. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by her, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, and Robert Garova. Valentina Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. And our theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. Our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn. From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, have a great rest of your weekend. We'll be back with a daily version of The Frame on Monday.